What if schools would be primarily concerned with students' well-being, concerned with helping students to develop the capabilities needed to live a flourishing life as students and later as adults? A vision of school education worth striving for? How might we go about achieving it? What do we need to consider? Where does this leave the teaching of traditional school subjects? Hello, my name is Thomas Falkenberg. I'm a professor in the Faculty of Education at the University of Manitoba and the host of the six-part podcast series, Wellbeing in Schools, that engages with this very idea of making school education primarily about student well-being and with a question that such an undertaking raises. The podcast series is linked to the book Wellbeing and Wellbecoming in Schools, which is published by the University of Toronto Press. I'm the editor of the book, and the guests invited to different episodes of this podcast series are authors of chapters in this book. The episode you're currently listening to is the last in a series of six episodes. For each of the last four episodes, I invited some of my colleagues to share with us their expertise, insights, and understandings about particular questions that arise from the idea of making school education primarily about student well-being. In this last episode, I will draw these ideas together to provide, I hope, a broad understanding of what it might, could, and maybe should mean for school education to be primarily about student well-being. To do so, I will lean on what my colleagues shared with us over the last four episodes. I will literally have them come to speak to us again on some of the core issues they spoke about in their respective episodes. And where do we best begin but the most foundational question that public school education faces, namely the question, what is our, that means our society's, vision for our children and their lives as children and as future adults? In episode one, I presented to the listeners a list of capabilities and experiences that my daughter and her husband wished for Evan, their then newly born son. Here is a clip from this first episode. Not long after his birth, his parents attended a provincial parenting support program. During one of the program sessions, my daughter and her husband were asked to create a list of qualities that they wished Evan would develop. They wrote and laminated the list and put it up on their fridge, where it still hangs. Let's call the list Evan's List. The list of capabilities and experiences that his parents wished for Evan runs as follows. What we'd like for Evan: feels loved and cared for, cares about others, family-oriented, enjoys life, healthy, honest, motivated, open-minded, good listener, good problem-solver, manages stress well. With reference to this list, I made a few points in episode one. First, children's well-being is at the heart of what parents wish and envision for their children and their lives as children and future adults. Second, the capabilities and experiences that characterize this vision for children's lives are typically not found among the core goals of school education. Third, I made the following point about why this mismatch between our vision for our children and what school education is officially about is problematic. Well, that means that the capabilities on Evan's list are not just educationally worthwhile to develop, they are also capabilities that someone would greatly benefit learning about from someone with professional expertise in teaching it. It is for this reason that well-being, illustrated by the capabilities on Evan's list, should be school educational goals, because schools hire highly educated professionals to support children's learning of educational goals. In other words, by not focusing on well-being capabilities and experiences, school education misses out on making a beneficial educational contribution to the developing of these well-being capabilities. Even further, in order to match the importance of well-being in the vision of parents for their children and their lives as children and future adults, school education would need to be primarily about student well-being. But what does this mean? Here's what I suggested in episode one. So what does it mean that school education is primarily about student well-being, and why should that be so? Well, it means that well-being capabilities, like the ones on Evan's list, are educational ends for school education, meaning that life in school and the teaching of curriculum are guided by the vision that what in the end matters to school education is students' well-being, as students and later as adults. But why should that be so? Because people need these well-being capabilities in order to live a flourishing life, and school education provides a professional context in which these capabilities can be learned and developed. Is the chance to live a flourishing life not what we all seek out, regardless whether we are adults or children? Once we have seen value in or even committed to the notion that school education should be primarily about student well-being because it matches what we are most concerned about for our children, a number of foundational questions arise. Episode 2 with my guests Eric Magnusson and Heather Krepsky discussed a number of these foundational questions. And the first question is, of course, what do we mean by well-being? In response to this question, Eric said the following.
Well, I think a useful place for approaching this type of question is to distinguish the general concept of well-being from the different theories of how to interpret that particular concept. So in the philosophical literature, the general concept of well-being is normally understood as indicating what is non-instrumentally or ultimately good for a person. So in this understanding, well-being is sort of a measure of how well a person's life is going for that person or from the perspective of their own interests. So things that have a positive effect on a person's well-being are things that are good for that person or which benefit them or contribute to their advantage, whereas things that have a negative effect on a person's well-being are things that are bad for that person or which harm them or detract from their interest or advantage. Now, different theories of well-being provide different accounts of what is ultimately good for a person and why.
Here, Eric has laid out for us a general understanding of well-being. Well-being refers to what is ultimately good for a person. Following this general explanation, Eric described the three classes of theories of what that specifically means and how each of these theories have been challenged. What interests us for the purpose of this current episode in terms of understanding well-being are the following 2 points. First, we need to understand that we need to make explicit our understanding of what well-being means if we want school education to be primarily about student well-being, and that engaging with different theories of well-being is probably a good way of doing so. Second, we need to understand that the question of how to understand well-being is a question that teachers already face in their classrooms on an ongoing basis, not as a theoretical and conceptual question, but as one of practical relevance as they make their pedagogical decisions. Heather made this point well in episode 2.
So for instance, we might want to give students opportunity to express their autonomy and make choices in the classroom. But then we might worry, oh, are they making bad choices? So we're driven by a desire to support their autonomy because we think that will make them well. And really what we're operating under is the assumption that a sort of desire fulfillment theory of understanding will create opportunities for well-being. But then if we see them make what we determine to be bad choices in the classroom, they might, as Eric mentioned, satisfy unhealthy desires, choose things that are impractical or harmful as their, you know, learning processes. We might see that their hedonic well-being, you know, is satisfied because they're interested in what they're studying, but maybe they haven't chosen to prepare themselves for something more useful in the future, which is another area of well-being, that sort of desire fulfillment piece around creating challenges for themselves. Maybe students aren't challenging themselves and they aren't trying to overcome adversity and experience that kind of well-being. So different types of well-being might be achieved differently in the classroom and without an understanding as a teacher. That can create tensions without really knowing why.
What Heather points out here is that teachers regularly engage in pedagogical decision-making that is about and that impacts students' well-being. However, those decisions are generally grounded in an implicit rather than explicit understanding of student well-being. Thus, teachers' practices would greatly benefit from an explicit engagement of teachers and the education system more generally with different conceptual understandings of student well-being, the respective challenges that each faces, and how they relate to each other. Another fundamental question that an education system that wants to make student well-being a primary focus is the question whether such focus is concerned with well-being of students as students or as future adults. Curricular decisions by the provincial governments are made with the students' future as adults in mind. However, to argue for well-being as a major educational concern in schools, we should also consider the well-being of students as children as a major educational concern. Heather said the following about the importance of not simply conflating the well-being needs of students as future adults with the well-being needs of students as students.
I love these debates about child well-being versus adult well-being. And I think a lot about whether there are things that can be accessed for children that can't be accessed in adulthood. So if we don't access these opportunities for well-being for children while they're in childhood, they might lose the opportunities. So some examples that I recall reading about from, I think it was Anke Gauss. So I love how she points out, you know, children have special access to trusting relationships. She says they're better philosophers and scientists than adults are by nature, which I agree with. She says that they can trust and love indiscriminately, which of course might get them into dangerous situations, but also sounds lovely in another sense. So giving children these opportunities to access these special goods or opportunities of childhood sounds really important. But of course, there are those that think that's misguided and that's actually maybe not the case. And perhaps adults can access, you know, imagination and play and all of these things if we just give them more opportunities to do so. So I think those debates are really interesting. What stands out for me when comparing children's well-being versus adult well-being in this now turns really to the important special role that teachers have in students' lives is that children's well-being is typically secured differently than adult well-being. And so, as Eric mentioned, adults make important decisions every day on behalf of children based on what they think will yield the best results. And we don't even know how each individual understands those results or assigns value to those results. So as adults, you know, all from different backgrounds and having different value systems and personalities, we're going to weight differently various aspects of student well-being, and that's going to govern a lot of our decisions on their behalf.
Let me summarize the broad understanding that I've derived from the first two episodes for what might, could, and maybe should mean for school education to be primarily about student well-being. As a society, and particularly as parents, we want our children to have the capabilities and experiences that are relevant to our children's well-being as students and as future adults. However, current school education does not have these capabilities and experiences as its primary focus. That is a mismatch. To address this mismatch, we need a school education system that makes student well-being a primary focus. If it does so, it faces a number of foundational questions, among which the most foundational would be, what do we mean by student well-being? There are different approaches to understanding student well-being, and school education would greatly benefit from a serious engagement with these discourses on the concept of human well-being and child well-being, as they already exist in various disciplines of research and scholarship. As well, classroom teachers would benefit from such engagement since they are actually already engaged on a day-to-day basis with the question, what is good for my students and what is good for this particular student? An understanding of student well-being would provide a framework for teachers to respond intentionally and systematically to these all-important questions. The question of how to understand student well-being transitions nicely to some of the ideas presented in episode 3, where Frank Deer, Leslie Ebley-Trudell, and Jeannie Kerr were my guests. In this third episode, my guests focused on the role of community in school education around student well-being. Schools are located in specific places, and as such, they draw students from a certain area, creating, by default, a larger school community. In most Canadian provinces, such school communities are defined through the school division boundaries and within such boundaries through schools' catchment areas and through families of schools. In episode 3, Frank, Leslie, and Jeannie made the case that schools need to partner, not just consult, with the community in which they are located. Here's what Jeannie said on the need for true partnership.
I think how we've traditionally looked at communities and parents as somebody that we need to consult with, that we need to check in with, that, you know, we need to make sure they're happy. But I think my focus really brings it to how can we be true partners with community? I think specifically in the context that I'm talking about, where there's been a lot of exclusions, that's been really to the detriment of the students as well as the communities. So often, you know, the value of community knowledge isn't really seen as something for the curriculum, as something that guides the ethos and ways of participating in the school. And this, I think, really has an effect of bringing a division within the students, where they see their connections to their community as and their belonging and community as very distinctly different and not as welcomed in terms of what happens in the school. So that if there's this partnership, we can create this more holistic place for students to actually be who they are and not feel that they have to be different ways in different places. And that, you know, in terms of curriculum as well, the community has an amazing capacity to enrich the curriculum with ways of knowing that really disrupt the Eurocentricity that I think is widely recognized as problematic for all students in terms of their knowledge locally and globally. And so the way of thinking about the languages as needing to be reclaimed and brought back in as part of students' identity, as well as community identity, I think is central to what communities can really offer schools.
An illustrated example of the importance of partnering with a school community for the benefit of students' well-being was provided by Frank when he drew on his own experience as a teacher in northern Manitoba.
My first job was in a community called Opapanapewin. Your listeners may be more familiar with its other name, South Indian Lake. It's in northern Manitoba. And it's a First Nation now. It was an incorporated community at the time. K to 10, interesting place. A Cree community for your listeners. And there have been schools like Oscar Blackburn School, which was the school in the community, that took on board this idea that community involvement in the growth of their children extended beyond the home and can have an important place in school and such. And there was an interface between the community and the school for a variety of things. For instance, they adjusted the school year so that students finished early so that they would go do what they had to do every year, go on the trap line, go to the fish camp and those sorts of things, right?
This, as Frank called it elsewhere, community-based school education links schools closely with the communities whose children they formally educate. It also creates the understanding that the well-being of students is intricately linked to the well-being of the community and vice versa, a point that Jeannie made in the following clip.
And I think kind of the recognition that the school is sitting in a community, that the well-being of the students in that school is connected to the well-being of the community that is surrounding the school, I think would go a long way to just shifting the focus to understanding how much we need to really be a part of the engagement that we have in the educational activities we do in different places and be more responsive to it in that way.
However, schools are not just located in and connected with communities. They are also part of a larger social framework of broader social values, norms, and expectations beyond a single community. These larger social frameworks, Leslie argued in episode 3, need to also be considered in our understanding of student well-being. Here's the point she made.
That role of community is so essential to the conversation about belonging and identity and engagement and ultimately well-being. And from my perspective, because I work at more of an organizational level and look at this from a broader perspective, you know, what happens in community is really framed by the international work, the national, the provincial archetypes. So some examples of that might be the United Nations conventions, the Canadian Constitution, in particular, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, also provincial education legislation. So it might be things like safe schools amendments or accessibility legislation, perhaps workplace health and safety legislation. So all of these things do frame the work that happens in community. And although community members often don't see these system structures, the structures are what I believe to be the key to the function and success, or perhaps lack thereof, in day-to-day practice.
So what are some of the elements of that partnership work that needs to be done by schools, communities, and society at large? Frank, Jeannie, and Leslie provided some examples. For instance, Frank spoke of the connection between the well-being of the community and the well-being of students in that community, and thus the work that needs to be done in this regard, like the need for language development in both schools and communities. For most indigenous languages, such development is an existential concern, and language competency is cultural competency, which in turn provides for a culturally grounded understanding of well-being. Here's Frank speaking about an example of a language program in one school division.
There's a few schools in Western Canada that appear to be getting this somewhat right. The immersion approach that is taken up by some of these schools, there's one school in Mystery Lake School District up north that's called Wapanak, and it's very close to an immersion program. And they are offering this close to an immersion program. It's complicated, and it almost delves into politics, the manner through which a school can say that they have an immersion program. But it's not just an immersion program. It's picking up on some of the things that we've already discussed. It picks up on the inclusion of community membership in these ways. It picks up on some of the, let's call them, community orientations to life and well-being.
Jeannie spoke of the need for work at the level of respect and perspective, like seeing especially racialized and low-income communities as resilient rather than deficient relative to the challenges that they are being made to face. Here's Jeannie again.
You know, some of the research I've been doing says that kind of the issue that comes up is that, well, in particular in low-income communities that are racialized and under pressure, the schools see the community in a deficit perspective, something that needs to be fixed, rather than the resilient communities that are responding to long-term settler colonialism and global migration pressures. So to see them as strong and that they're relevant can help them also rebuild and reform their relationships.
Finally, Leslie pointed out that if we want to make student well-being a central focus of school education, we need to not just be able to assess or measure well-being, we also need to do so regularly to inform practice and policy. Here's what Leslie said on this point.
Again, what needs to change from my perspective? Well, I think we have to ask ourselves, you know, how are we really doing in terms of well-being, and how do we know how we're doing? In Ontario, of course, again, I refer back to Ontario, it leads the way in terms of Canadian provinces on efforts to measure well-being in schools. And we know that what is measured is valued, and what is valued gets accomplished. And so until we can really measure or define well-being more accurately, and I talked about some definitions in past questions, I think it moves beyond literacy and numeracy.
Let me summarize what I would derive from the third episode for a broad understanding of what it might, could, and maybe should mean for school education to be primarily about student well-being. In our concern for students' well-being, we need to understand that schools and its students are embedded into particular communities. These communities are generally, but not always, characterized by the catchment area of a school or of a family of schools. While such a community can in Canada be quite culturally diverse, especially in urban areas, a local cultural structure for these school communities should nevertheless be identifiable, characterized by the practices and values expressed in school board policies and parental and communal concerns for school educational matters. Schools thus need to be seen as an integral part of that community, which is why local representation in school political matters is so important. However we understand student well-being, this understanding needs to integrate the fact that students' lives are integrally connected to the quality of life in the community. Thus, with its concern for students' well-being, the education system needs to also be concerned with and for the flourishing of the community the students belong to. Central to this concern is a true partnership of the school with the larger school community that goes beyond consultations with the community to allow for true community-based school education. Such a partnership could be, for instance, institutionalized by making the school a core community hub. But schools are not just embedded into local communities, and students are not just members of their local community. They are also living in a province and country. Even further, they live in a world in which all countries are more or less connected through economic and political relationships, so that each and every one of us is implicated, be it through their actions as economic consumers or their political action or inaction, in the lives of people living around the world. Educational values, practices, and policies need to reflect these transcommunal and transnational values like human rights and child rights. In episode 4, I invited Virginia Tse and Cameron Hausman to talk about the well-being of the adults working in schools. Because of their respective research expertise, we focused on the well-being of school administrators, particularly principals, and on school psychologists. The well-being of adults working in schools should be of importance when we are concerned for well-being in schools more generally for two reasons. The first reason connects well with what we just heard about community-based school education, in particular about how well-being in schools is and should be seen as being linked to the well-being of the community. Schools are places of work for teachers, administrators, office and custodial staff, school divisional personnel like school psychologists, and others. As a society, we should be concerned for the well-being at work. Workplaces are places where adults spend a lot of their time, generally 7 to 8 hours per day for 5 days a week. As such, they are crucial contexts and opportunities for people's well-being or ill-being. And if we are concerned for the well-being of the community in which the school is located, as was suggested by my guests of episode 3, then we need to care about the well-being of all those adults working in schools as members of that community. The second reason why a school system that is primarily concerned for student well-being should also be concerned for the well-being of the adults working in schools is the fact that these adults work with students in one way or another. If these adults are not well, it would negatively impact the role that these adults can play for the well-being of students. When we are not well, our behavior towards and our perception of these around us change, and generally not for the better. On the other hand, when we enjoy our life and work, when we find meaning in our work life, and when we have supportive social relationships at work and in our personal life, in other words, when our life is characterized by well-being, it generally should make it easier and more likely for us to respond to those around us with interest, sensitivity, and understanding. We generally should have a more supportive and uplifting impact on those around us. So how is the well-being situation for school principals and school psychologists? Cameron and Virginia said the following in episode 4.
The most troubling and concerning finding to emerge from my research with principals is that even our most experienced and effective school leaders still demonstrate a proclivity for engaging in coping strategies associated with negative outcomes. So these maladaptive, as they say, coping strategies include things like worrying about events over which they have little or no control, masking emotions using expressive suppression, using thought suppression to deal with symptoms of emotional exhaustion by simply trying to turn off one's brain, distraction, manipulating the emotions of others, using illegal or prescription drugs, alcohol, or other forms of self-medication. All of this data and information regarding principals' wellness and well-being is important because these folks won't be able to fully realize their influence on student outcomes if they're struggling to cope with the demands of the job.
So for school psychologists, we also noticed a very similar pattern. Hutella and colleagues in 2017 talked about the impact of ethical dilemmas and how those ethical dilemmas affect school psychologists. And the ethical dilemmas that often faced by school psychologists are deciding whose needs is greater, which student can wait, which can't. And this put them into a really challenging situation and affects their well-being because of a range of the psychological duties and tasks to conduct.
In response to the question, what could or should be done out of concern for the well-being of school principals and school psychologists, Cameron and Virginia provided some suggestions. To generalize, I want to draw on two particular points they made. First, the school division's response needs to be grounded in a general understanding of what we mean by human well-being, which brings us back to the foundational questions that we discussed earlier in this episode. Virginia made this point when she referenced a particular theory of psychological well-being, the quite influential self-determination theory, and its concept of human well-being as meeting three basic human needs.
And when Thomas, you asked, what does it look like and how to support school counselors and school psychologists in terms of their well-being? And I would like to draw on the self-determination theory. It talks about three basic psychological needs, and they are autonomy, relatedness, and competency. And these are the important elements to support well-being based on the self-determination theory and is applicable to school psychologists and school counselors. And I believe this might also be applicable to principals as well about like supporting what they need to achieve a more well-rounded professional well-being. If we tie back to the self-determination theory, it is reasonable to say that an autonomy supportive environment will increase school psychologists' well-being because school psychologists are working and serving multiple schools. And the literature are pointing to the direction that providing a collegial support and a sense of community will be important, which is also highlighted in Huita, Le, and the colleague study in 2017.
The second general point that Cameron and Virginia made in terms of staff well-being was that there are also profession-specific aspects of addressing staff well-being. Cameron illustrated this approach to more profession-specific support for the case of principals' well-being as follows.
So then the question becomes, how do they mitigate those challenges? How are they addressed? Well, let's talk about supports, preparation, and professional learning. Because the professional learning opportunities, leadership preparation programs, and supports available to assist principals in navigating the extent of the emotional terrain involved in their work and these numerous challenges to their well-being, they simply haven't kept pace with the changing nature of these leadership roles in schools. Too often, leadership preparation programs neglect to interrogate the fundamental role that things like well-being, and not just a principal's own well-being, but how they promote and stoke well-being in others throughout the school and build those positive school climates. Things like emotional labor and managing emotions. Well, leadership preparation programs simply haven't covered these things in enough detail. Further, emotional intelligence is usually the sole focus when emotions are included in curricula for leadership development programming and other professional learning opportunities. This is a really narrow and skill-based narrative surrounding the place for emotions and also well-being in school leadership, and it really comes at the expense of the totality of the emotional experiences that occur in schools and the reasons why individuals sort of respond in these ways. So how can we increase well-being among our principal population? What can be done in these professional learning opportunities and leadership preparation programs? Well, Thomas, I'd say the first thing we need to do, it's essential that emotional literacy becomes part of the core body of knowledge, of skills and competencies that school leaders need to demonstrate prior to entering an administrative position.
Let me summarize what I would derive from the fourth episode for a broad understanding of what it might, could, and maybe should mean for school education to be primarily about student well-being. School educational concern for well-being needs to include the concern for the well-being of the employees working in the school system. As I've argued, a school system that makes student well-being a primary concern would do so out of its recognized responsibility for the quality of life of the students as students and future adults. However, school systems also bear responsibility for their employees, and it would be almost hypocritical if school divisions would argue for their recognized central role in contributing to the well-being for students, but then deny a similar recognition of its role in the well-being of the adults working in the school division. But employee well-being is not just an ethical responsibility, but also a practical one. How well a school as an organization works depends on the qualification, but also on the motivation of its employees and the motivation of people to become employees. Thus, school systems should have a functional interest in contributing and promoting the well-being of its employees. Research on needed support and the forms that such support should take is available and can direct school divisions' professional development. In episode 5, we arrived at what is at the heart of formal school education, the implementation of curriculum through classroom-based pedagogy. As such, both curriculum and pedagogy play a central role in helping students develop capabilities and provide them with experiences relevant to their well-being. My guests in episode 5, Michael Link and Jennifer Watt, helped us making sense of the ideas of well-being curricula and well-being pedagogies. Let's first focus on the idea of a well-being curriculum. Here we have two general approaches. The first general approach is to offer standalone well-being curriculum. Of course, what such well-being curriculum looks like depends on how we understand student well-being. If for the moment we accept that understanding how to live physically and mentally healthy lives and understanding how to build good relationships are important topics in a well-being curriculum, then we can see that in Canada, we already have some examples of standalone well-being curricula. There's, for instance, the health curriculum that has been introduced across Canada over the last few years, and that seems to be generally taught in conjunction with the physical education curriculum. The health curriculum is a standalone curriculum addressing core aspects of living a healthy life. There's also, at least in the province of Manitoba, a standalone human ecology and family studies curriculum. The family studies curriculum, for instance, includes learning outcomes linked to understanding human development and interpersonal relationships, both central to developing capabilities for building human relationships and understanding one's own development, both important to human well-being. The problem with these standalone well-being curricula in Canadian provinces is that they are quite peripheral in terms of teaching time dedicated to them and in terms of their status compared to traditional subjects like English language arts, mathematics, the natural and social sciences. The health curriculum is given relatively small amount of class time, and curricula like the one for human ecology and family studies are optional rather than required for students to take. Generally, these standalone well-being curricula have a very low status compared to the so-called academic subjects, meaning that these courses are not priority options for students, especially those who want to go on to some form of higher education, which are between a third and a half of all Canadian students. The second general approach to implementing the idea of a well-being curriculum is to integrate a well-being curriculum into what is already there and dominant in terms of teaching time and regard, namely traditional school subjects. In episode 5, Mike and Jen spoke to the need for such integration. They did so because how students and all of us more generally experience life and how they live their lives are not neatly separated into subject-specific issues, but rather in form of holistic experiences that have aspects touched by different subjects. Here are Mike and Jen again.
I would just argue that it would make a lot more sense to ground all of the skills, knowledge, values of subjects like science and language arts within, you know, big ideas, themes, or problems rather than separate subjects. That's what, you know, life, that's how things work.
Yeah, I think I really agree with that, that life isn't divided up into, you know, these kind of subject matters. And certainly once you leave school, you don't think about your life in terms of like, oh, I'm doing English language arts right now, or I'm doing some math. I mean, we do have those experiences that are more like that. But I think that really this idea of looking at integrating learning in more interdisciplinary ways, particularly in ways that put inquiry or meaning making or discovery or connections at the center of what we do. And I think that that's really at the heart of what schooling for well-being is really about. But, you know, when I do think about, so why did we get here and why did we have these core subjects? And I try to think of it in a more generous way or in an appreciative way. I can understand why they continue to be considered important, because how they're central to unlocking some potential for people to become meaning makers in the world.
The point that I take from Jen's last comment is that the particular perspectives and the knowledge and skills that traditional subjects provide to us are important in our daily life and our understanding of the world, and thus to our ability to live well in this world. However, a subject-specific structuring of school curriculum needs to be done for the right reason. It is clearly not a right reason to structure school curricula by academic subjects because university departments want high school students to develop what these departments consider prerequisite knowledge for when they take up studies in these fields. Most students will not attend university after high school graduation, and an even smaller percentage of K-12 students will enroll in any given academic subject. Good reason to at least give K-12 students a sense of academic subject-specific knowledge and skills is that the division into university-based fields of research provide us with somewhat different ways of understanding us and the social and ecological life around us. But the point that Mike and Jen make is that even though we benefit from subject-specific knowledge, students need to be helped to make sense of this knowledge in the context of their and others' lives. And that means that subject-specific knowledge and skills need to be integrated across subjects in order to arrive at knowledge for life, which is, as Mike suggested, what is needed. Such integrated knowledge for life is needed because to live well, we need to be able to deal with the challenges that life makes us face. And those challenges always come in forms that integrate the different aspects dealt with in different disciplines. Thus, an integrative approach to a well-being curriculum would focus on the implementation of traditional subject curricula through the use of well-being pedagogies. Mike provided the following example of how a focus on capabilities and experiences linked to student well-being can be integral to the implementation of traditional subjects.
Yeah, when I think about that space, I would say we should look at framing the curriculum in terms of meaningful work that actually engages students to begin asking questions about what they find in their schools, their playgrounds, nearby nature, their communities, and then to pursue answers to their questions and collaborate to take action to address issues or concerns. Two obvious areas that I discuss in the chapter in our book are ecological injustice and social injustice. So with child well-being and well-becoming in mind, the lessons that guide a project-based approach, for example, would have at their core the design of opportunities that allow students to develop capabilities that are linked to human needs.
Jen also provided examples of well-being pedagogies that integrate well-being aspects into the implementation of the English language arts curriculum. Here's one of those examples.
So Elizabeth Dutro does some really beautiful work about how can we actually put trauma at the center of what we do in terms of literacy studies as well, and that's not ill-being, that's not centering ill-being, but it's creating space for well-being so that you can hold both. You can hold a hard experience or difficult experience, as well as a space of feeling connecting with others. And I think that that's some of the really exciting moments for me in English language arts and where I think that it really contributes to well-being.
In episode 5, Jen and Mike gave concrete examples of what I would call integrative well-being pedagogies, namely pedagogies that engage students with capabilities and experiences linked to their well-being as part of the implementation of traditional school subjects. Mike, for instance, described how he has used the lens of capabilities linked to human needs to teach learning outcomes of the science curriculum, while Jen described the idea of a walking curriculum, where walking in the neighborhood or in parks can inspire forms and content for writing texts. But where are we across Canada with integrated well-being curricula and well-being pedagogies? Here's what Mike shared about the school curriculum in British Columbia.
I can give you one example that I came across in BC's curriculum revision. Core component that they've included is the development of communicative, personal, and social abilities. So this, they describe communication, and this is a quote, as being fundamental to finding satisfaction, purpose, and joy. So the personal and social abilities outlined are described as encompassing what students need to find and achieve their purposes in the world. And I think that's an example of a step in the right direction as far as bringing teaching and learning for student well-being to life. I think that if we want teachers to intentionally design opportunities for well-being and well-becoming, and their planning and curricula needs to reflect this. And I strongly believe that the vast majority of teachers have their students' well-being in mind already. What I suspect has been lacking in many classrooms is a clear or explicit approach to supporting well-being. In some cases, what might not be there is the chance to articulate what it is the teachers are already doing to develop abilities needed for well-being. So, for example, many teachers of young children will provide opportunities for their students to develop the capability to make and maintain friendships, whether it's part of the curriculum or not. Teachers do this because they know children need friends to be happy. From my own experience as a teacher working with many other kind and caring teachers, I suspect there are already a lot of educators who are providing these kinds of opportunities. But if we really value the well-being of children, then we need to spell this out as a goal of education and intentionally plan for it.
To pick up on Mike's last point, teachers do value students' well-being in their day-to-day interaction with them and in their lesson planning. They do so when they provide students with extra help during the lunchtime. They do so when they give a student a due date extension on an assignment because the student is going through a difficult time at home. And they do so when they give students choices in, for instance, the selection of the novel they are to read next. A lot can already be done about helping students with the development of capabilities and with experiences linked to their well-being in the given curricular context in Canada. Jen made that very point.
I think that one of the things that I would really highlight is that teachers, you're already doing it, right? Like, and I think we've just been saying that over and over again in this episode. Yeah, this is what we're already doing. And I guess the takeaway would be, how can we be more intentional about it? How can we know for ourselves, name it, value it, and continue to prioritize it? I think that's the big challenge and where this work is developing and growing. And I think when you are able to kind of name it and see it, then it continues to be a really important part of what we can begin to do in schools around well-being and well-becoming, and provide people with language for well-being and well-becoming as they move out throughout their lives, right? So if that's been something that's been part of their school experiences, then they're able to see that in the world beyond themselves as well, and think about, you know, how am I contributing in this moment? How am I helping connect with someone else or provide joy in this experience? And I think that as we start to develop that, then it grows. And it's not just about flourishing in schools, but our communities begin to flourish in new ways as well.
Let me summarize what I would derive from the fifth episode for a broad understanding of what it might, could, and maybe should mean for school education to be primarily about student well-being. Let me start with a very general point that can be made. From a school educational perspective, what counts in the end for students' education are the kinds of experiences students have in school. It is the type and quality of these experiences that can support or undermine the implementation of the notion that schools are primarily about student well-being. For the in-class experiences, this means that what is core to the quality of these experiences are, first, what ideas and skills students encounter and are asked to engage with as part of the classroom learning in school, and second, how they encounter these ideas and skills. In other words, what curricular content and what pedagogical engagement students experience in class are central to the enactment of any vision of school education that wants to be primarily about the well-being of students, as students and future adults. Starting from this very general point, there are a number of demands on the curricular content and the pedagogical engagement. Let's start with the curricular content. If school education is concerned with the well-being of students as future adults, then the curricular content cannot just be about what is generally called academic content knowledge and skills, which is more or less what a selected group of subject areas taught at university are concerned with. Mathematics, the natural and social sciences, and English language and literature come here particularly to mind. It is telling that school curricular content in Canada is structured more or less in accordance with the disciplinary structure at Canadian universities. If the Canadian school system is to be concerned with student well-being as adults, then the school curriculum needs to be primarily about what matters to the well-being of all adults, regardless of the work path they pursue. We need to keep in mind that for any given career path, there's only a small and sometimes very small group of students who pursue that path. Designing general school education with the learning needs of types of career paths, like getting a university degree, will always only be of service to a minority of students in schools. On the other hand, there's a lot to be learned about living a flourishing life in a country like Canada that applies to all students as future adults. The book Critical Lessons, What Our Schools Should Teach, by the late American philosopher of education, Nell Noddings, provides some examples of curricular content that is relevant to the adult lives of all students. Going by the table of contents of her book, Noddings suggested the need to learn about self-understanding, about other people, about house and home, about parenting, about animals and nature, about making a living, about gender and religion. This would make for quite a different structure of curricular learning outcomes than what we currently have for schools to teach. Such a different curricular structure would clearly require the more integrated and holistic curriculum Mike and Jen talked about in episode 5, even if we create such a holistic curriculum with the help of subject-specific knowledge. The curricular content question is also raised when we are concerned with the well-being of students as students. From the perspective of this concern, the curricular content cannot be just about students' lives after high school graduation, but should also address learning needs that students have in order to live a flourishing life as students, in school and outside of school. Students as children and youth have many questions about their lives and the world as it impacts their well-being. They develop curiosity and want to know about themselves, about their inner life, about anger and other emotions, about resilience in the face of traumatic experiences, about how to deal with being bullied and being stressed, about friendship, love, sex, and sexuality, about life after death, about God, religious beliefs, and spirituality, about death and about addiction to technology and drugs, about how to deal with setbacks, parents, and other adults. These and many other topics come up as children develop mentally and physically and as they are exposed to the adult world in more than one way. To leave our children alone with these questions or to leave them up there searching the internet for answers seems quite irresponsible in light of the support that educators can provide, if they as educators are ready and prepared for such inquiries. Also, to deal with such topics in an intentional and planned way, space needs to be made in the school curriculum for topics that we can see and that students tell us are relevant to them because they affect their well-being. As I said earlier, if school education is to be primarily about student well-being, there are not just demands on the curricular content, there are also demands on the ways teachers pedagogically engage students in this curricular content. Let's call such pedagogies well-being pedagogies. Mike and Jen gave some examples of such well-being pedagogies, like when they suggested walks in nature as a way of engaging students in a creative writing process, or when they suggested that students use an ecological or social injustice lens to look at their community. These are examples of pedagogies that are undertaken with a well-being curriculum in mind. Mindfulness activities in mathematics class and giving students choice in the selection of the next book reading in the English class are other examples that come to mind. As I said earlier, from a school educational perspective, what counts in the end for students' education are the kinds of experiences students have in schools. What matters for the classroom-based experiencing of well-being and the developing of capabilities for living a flourishing life are well-being curricula and well-being pedagogies. Since both depend on how we understand human well-being, we are circling back from teaching and learning for well-being to the foundational questions that we discussed at the beginning of this sixth episode. That suggests that if we want to make the well-being of students, as students and future adults, a primary concern of school education, then all aspects of school education that we heard about in this podcast series need to fit together. Our understanding of what we mean by well-being informs what we mean when we say that school education should be primarily about students' well-being. How we implement such a purpose of school education needs to be aligned with the needs and wishes of and contributions by the community the students come from. The concern for student well-being needs to extend to a concern for the well-being of all members of this community. The same concern needs also be extended to the adults that work with and for students in the school. And students' classroom experiences need to be framed and guided by well-being pedagogies in the implementation of a well-being curriculum. All these aspects of school education are interconnected and need to be addressed if we truly want to have the desired impact on students' well-being in a school system that is primarily about student well-being as students and future adults. I sincerely hope that our six-part podcast series, as well as the book upon which the podcast series has been developed, contribute to making the case for a school system with such a purpose, and for the understanding that all aspects of school education need to be aligned in order to implement school education for student well-being. Thank you for listening. This concludes the sixth and last episode of the six-part podcast series, Well-Being in Schools. This podcast series was produced in the broadcast studio of UMFM 101.5. The studio is located on the Fort Garry campus of the University of Manitoba and is thus located on original lands of Anishinaabeg, Cree, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and on the national homeland of the Red River Métis. Creating this series involved the participation and support of a number of people and organizations, and with this being the last episode of the series, I want to acknowledge and express my appreciation for this support, without which this podcast series would not have been created, or not in this form, anyways. First, I want to acknowledge the contributions by Eric Magnusson. You might remember him as one of my guests in the second episode. Eric was actually the one who came up with the idea to create a podcast series based on the book Well-Being and Well-Becoming in Schools that he and my other guests in this series have contributed chapters to. So without Eric, this series would never have been. Eric was also instrumental in making the connection to the radio station that produced and now hosts the podcast series, and Eric was also a co-applicant of a funding application that provided the financial support for the creation of this podcast series. I want to acknowledge the contributions of my guests over the last four episodes who provided the ideas about well-being in schools that are at the core of this series. Without their contributions, there would have been no series. Thank you to Heather Krepsky, Eric Magnusson, Frank Deer, Jeannie Kerr, Leslie Ebley-Trudell, Cameron Hausman, Virginia Tse, Michael Link, and Jennifer Watt. To all of you, I appreciated your willingness to share your expertise and to be part of a project that is somewhat different from your usual academic work. The different episodes in this series are based on ideas these scholars wrote about in the already mentioned book, Wellbeing and Wellbecoming in Schools. The book is published by the University of Toronto Press. To create a podcast series requires technical expertise in producing it. This expertise was provided by UMFM 101.5 radio station and its staff, particularly by station manager Jarek Makityak, who gave very graciously time and expertise to the planning and production of this podcast series. The producer of this podcast series was Sarah Schur, who was at the time of hiring for her work on this series a student in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Manitoba. A big thank you, Sarah, for your technical expertise that created, from the raw recordings, these beautiful podcast episodes. The background music that you can hear in each of the six episodes was created and performed by John Himes, a student in the Faculty of Music at the University of Manitoba. The podcast cover design that you can see linked to this podcast series on the website was created by Kyundok Park, a student in the School of Art at the University of Manitoba. Thank you to both of you for your contributions. Hiring Sarah as producer, John for the background music, and Kyundok for the cover design was made possible by a grant from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council. I appreciated that the adjudicators of our funding application to the Council saw value in the creation of a podcast series as a form of academic knowledge mobilization. Last but not least, I want to acknowledge the Faculty of Education of the University of Manitoba for being my academic home and for its ongoing support of my scholarly work, including through in-kind contributions to this podcast series. Thank you to staff and leadership of the faculty. This is the end of a project that I've been excited about since the very moment Eric suggested the idea of a podcast series. And this excitement has only increased once I saw what this project has been developed into. Ever since the series has been published freely available to the public, I've been eagerly sharing the link to it, and I hope you do so too, because I believe that the ideas presented in the series are worth sharing and to be considered as we continuously debate what we want for our children and their future, and what role school education can and should play in the implementation of this vision. May our children, and grandchildren in my case, go to school in a society in which the purpose and practice of school education is the way it is because it is what we truly believe we owe our children and their future.